Good morning, everyone. It's so great to see your faces, as always, every week that you're here. It's such a wonderful place, you know, that we have, that we grow this, like, spiritual community, this kahila of mutual support in our Jewish meditation and mindfulness practice, and we journey together down this spiritual path, nourishing each other each week. So, as always, it's great to see you. So this week's parsha is Shalach Lecha, the fourth parsha in the book of Numbers that we read about. We read about God telling Moses, Shalach Lecha, send for yourself. Basically, God is saying, send for yourself, because I already checked out the place and I think it's great, you know. But since you don't trust me, go ahead, send out some spies and see what you come up with. So send for yourself, send out 12 spies, a chieftain from each tribe, to scout out the land of Canaan. And it was important to send out one from each tribe because the tribes represent our ancestral tribes. So a chieftain from each one becomes a stronghold of, you know, like a kahal together. So when Moses sent them out to scout the land of Canaan, and he said to them, go up there into the Negev and into the hill country and see what kind of country it is. Are the people who dwell in it strong or weak, few or many? Is the country in which they dwell good or bad? Are the towns they live in open or fortified? Is the soil rich or poor? Is it wooded or not? And take pains to bring back some of the fruit of the land. And it goes on to say, the parsha goes on to say, and now it happened to be the season of the first ripe grapes. So the spies do as they're told, as they're ordered, and they go and scout the land and come back after 40 days to report to Moses and Aaron and the entire Israelite community that we came to the land you sent us to. It does indeed flow with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. And they cut down a cluster of grapes, and maybe they gathered a pomegranate or figs to bring back. However, they continue, the people who inhabit the country are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the Anakites there, and the Amalekites dwell in the Negev region, and the Hittites, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites inhabit the hill country, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan. And it was beginning to get a little bit negative and whiny. So Caleb comes in at this point and says, let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. And then the 10 spies reply, we cannot attack that people, for it is stronger than we. The country that we traversed and scouted is one that devours its settlers. All the people that we saw in it are men of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, and the Anakites are part of the Nephilim. And we look like grasshoppers to ourselves. And so we must have looked like grasshoppers to them. So now we have pandemonium among the Israelites, once again crying and complaining and, oh, I should have died in the land of Egypt. And only if we had, or only if we may die in this wilderness. And why did Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh take us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be carried off. It would be better for us to go back to Egypt. And then they say to one another, let us head back to Egypt. At this point, Moses and Aaron, it's as if they say no more, and they drop to their faces in front of the Israelites. And Caleb and then later Joshua come to the rescue. They tell the people, Caleb tells the people, the land that we traversed and scouted is exceedingly good land. If pleased with us, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh will bring us into that land, a land that flows with milk and honey, and give it to us. Only you must not rebel against Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Have no fear then of the people of the country, for they are our prey. Their protection has departed from them, but Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is with us. Have no fear of them. As the whole community threatened to pelt them with stones, the presence of the divine appeared in the tent of meeting to all the Israelites, at which point God says to Moses, "Ah, there they go again, not trusting me, not listening to what I have to say. That's it. I'm done." Sort of, I mean, that's not exactly what he says, but that's the gist of it. And he says, "This generation, for the next 40 years, will wander through the wilderness and will not be allowed to go into the land of Canaan, the land of milk and honey, except for Caleb and Joshua, who have been loyal to me." So the story is so interesting. It depicts these two opposing reactions to the same situation, the same environment. One reaction is that the 10 spies, being in total fear and helplessness. And the other reaction is of Caleb being confident and courageous, having hope and faith that his connection with the divine and with the qualities of confidence and courage will lead the Israelites to succeed in this new land. So there are many examples of hope and faith overcoming fear in the book of Psalms, and I'll just read a few that many of us are familiar with. Psalm 23, verse 4. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." In Psalm 34, verse 4 and 5. "I sought the Lord, and the Lord answered me and delivers me from my fears. Those who look to the Lord are radiant. Their faces shall never be ashamed." And Psalm 27, 1, verse 1. "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" So back to the spies who see themselves as merely grasshoppers, fragile, weak creatures set up against strong giants. The spies certainly have set themselves up for crushing failure. But Caleb, whose name actually means faithful, wholehearted, bold, or brave, and some people also think it might mean devotion of God, and later Joshua, they are able to face the unknown, take a leap of faith with confidence, and a positive emotional quality that will enable them to become leaders and guide the Israelites to conquer the land after wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. Their voices of hope and optimism are in sharp contrast to the dark, foreboding pessimism of the 10 spies. And one can surmise that hope and faith partnered with ritual and at times optimism are the reasons that we, the Jewish people, have been able to overcome so much tragedy throughout our history. The Kutzker Rebbe said that the essence of one's mission in life is to be true to oneself. Well, Caleb and Joshua were true to themselves. They were not swayed by the other 10 spies who comprised the majority of the scouting mission. Rabbi Asher Lopatin comments on this and says that Parsha Shelach Lecha is a warning about the dangers of too much unity of thought. He goes on to say, "Let us work on bringing the stranger not only into the community, but into our thinking. Let us embrace difference in order to thrive as a people and thrive in the land." And Rabbi Shefa Gold's commentary on the Parsha, she writes, "Over a lifetime, we are given glimpses, flashes, and hints that open our awareness to the reality of paradise and unity that underlines this world of constant flux. We are graced with a timeless moment in which the infinite is revealed as the source of our finite world. We are sent to that land of expanded consciousness through imagination, practice, she means meditation practice, and grace. We return from this state, from this taste of enlightenment, either empowered to receive and integrate the supreme blessing into our lives, or completely terrorized by the incomprehensible immensity of what we feel is beyond our grasp. The land eats up its inhabitants, reports the spies, and they are correct. The small, ego-driven, separate self cannot survive in the pure air of that land. The I will be dissolved, called by itself, called beyond itself, merging with the beauty and the mystery of that place. And a rabbi out in the Midwest, Rabbi Harris, comments, in many places around the world, human beings are living with fear of terrorism, fear of politicians, fear of losing freedoms, fear of people who are different, fear of things changing, and fear of things staying the same. This Torah portion shows that to get to the promised land, that is, relationship with God, community, and a sense of wholeness, we will face fearful times. Caleb exemplifies the hope of the promise and the confidence that hope can guide us through fear. Focusing on hope brings us through whatever wilderness we wander in. Striving to live a life of mitzvot, we are challenged with the task of spreading more hope than fear. We do this through the words we share, the prayers we recite, and the kindness we extend to others, the justice we pursue. We can each think of ourselves as shechelim, those sent out to survey the promised land. It is our place of milk and honey, our place of relationship with the divine, community, and wholeness. And of course, from the Buddhist perspective, fear is the root of suffering. And Dr. Pilar Jennings, a long-term practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism, a psychoanalyst with a focus on the clinical applications of Buddhist meditation, and an author, writes, "Think about what you fear. As you contemplate the answer, keep breathing slowly, deeply. The next time you feel afraid, your fears may be strong and real. They may be a response to intense pain. But deep within the body-mind system, there is a reliable and fast-acting remedy. Whether you call it Buddha nature, clear seeing, inner strength, or simply a regulated nervous system, the right medicine is available." I believe Jennings is talking about being present to the breath during meditation, or just being present in the moment. When we're present, paying attention to the breath, we experience this spaciousness in the sense that the fear cannot grip us as it may when we're not meditating. Staying in the present moment and connecting to the core of our beings, our neshama, our soul, allows us to embrace our fear rather than be overwhelmed by our fear. As we embrace our fear with loving kindness, it becomes less threatening, and we're able to examine it rather than run from it. We all know that fear is sometimes a good thing to have. As Robert Thurman, a Buddhist, writes, under normal circumstances, fear is not a problem. Fear is a healthy thing in general. It is awareness of danger. Fear is protective. It's what helps us to avoid wandering into a hungry lion's den. And John Dido Laurie, a Zen Buddhist Roshi who served as the abbot of the Zen Mountain Monastery and founder of the Mountains and Order and Rivers Order, writes, "The process of Zazen engages fear in order to empower fearlessness. We do not turn away from fear. When stuff comes up, we don't use Zazen as another vehicle for suppression. When something keeps coming up in meditation, that's a signal that you need to deal with it. You need to process it. You need to process it thoroughly and fearlessly, to feel it and experience it, and then let it go and come back to the moment. And our beloved teacher, meditation teacher, Sylvia Borstein says, fearlessness comes from benevolence and goodwill in the face of whatever oppresses you. And she recounts this beautiful story of the Buddha that I'm going to read to you. This is expressed beautifully, and she continues to write, this is expressed beautifully in one of the famous images of the Buddha depicting the night of his enlightenment. The Buddha is seated under the Bodhi tree, looking relaxed and contemplative, and apparently surrounded by a protective shield. Surrounding him are the Maras, all of the afflictions that assail the mind. Some have spears aimed at the Buddha, and some are disguised in erotic imagery, aiming to disrupt the Buddha's concentration, trying to generate the fear that comes from being attacked. But the Buddha sits unmoved, with one hand on the ground, as if to say, I have a right to be here. The shield that surrounds him, that protects him from these afflictions, is his benevolence, his own loving kindness shining out from him, is the dissolver of all afflictions. Our benevolence is actually the protection that renders enemies impotent. In the picture of the Buddha, as the spears and arrows come to touch the shield around the Buddha, they fall to the ground as flowers all around him. And Sylvia goes on to say, I like to think of those flowers as an illustration of how each of us, by cultivating steadfast goodwill, can dissolve the forces of confusion and fear in the world. And one more source from an Australian Tibetan Buddhist, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Charlag Kayabon Rinpoche. The Buddhist view is that fear is ubiquitous. We have an underlying sense of not being settled, of not being secure. We have an existential feeling of uncertainty and instability that makes us very anxious. When these emotions become inflamed, our fears grow. They compound. They go haywire. As the Buddha himself said, we get completely bogged down by fears of not getting what we want to have, being separated from what we have, getting what we do not want. Unless we have some kind of spiritual focus, we do not feel any real sense of groundedness, and so our efforts are not fruitful in the long run. We disperse our psychic and spiritual energies right and left and center, leaving ourselves exhausted and frustrated. We think we've missed out on this or that, or that everybody is an obstacle in our effort to improve ourselves. We want to have a certain kind of life, but everything is frustrating that. When we feel like that, all kinds of fears arise. Fear of death, of old age, of reality crumbling, of ending up being nothing or nobody. On the other hand, if we are secure in ourselves from having found some kind of spiritual focus, we learn how to gather our psychic and spiritual energies into ourselves. We can discover a kind of inner richness, the richness of our own spiritual cultivation. If we do that, we will experience a sense of groundedness that allows us to reduce and manage the fears we experience and eventually to overcome them. And now I'd like to return to the Parsha, to the ending of the Parsha, of Parsha Shalach Lecha, when when we have a little clip, like a story of a man found gathering wood on the Sabbath. He's brought before Moses and Aaron and kept in custody until God tells them that the man should be stoned to death. After the stoning, in verses 15, 37 to 41, God says to Moses as follows, "Speak to the Israelite people and instruct them to make for themselves fringes on the corners of their garments throughout the ages. Let them attach a cord of blue fringe to the fringe of each corner. That shall be your fringe. Look at it and recall all the commandments of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh and observe them so that you do not follow your heart and eyes in your lustful urge. Thus you shall be reminded to observe all my commandments and to be holy to your God. I, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, am your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I, your God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh." And of course, this is all about the tzitzit. And it's such an important part of the parsha because the tzitzit remind us to be, are supposed to remind us of what's important, of the mitzvot, being connected to the divine, being connected to something greater than ourselves. And we all need reminders. It's so important for us to have reminders, especially when we're afraid or fearful, that we have a reminder that there could be another place to experience this so that it's not overwhelming and overpowering. So these last verses about tzitzit are so important for us as we need these reminders. The Babylonian Talmud states, "Seeing leads to remembering, and remembering leads to doing." In other words, the purpose of remembering is to guide our behavior. And the instruction of the tzitzit is seen as an important reminder for the entirety of our religious practice, so much so that our sages incorporated the verses into the Shema, which is one of the most central prayers in Judaism, which we say twice a day, morning and evening. So we look at the tzitzit, a symbol of faith and steadfastness, lema'an tizkeru, so that we remember that the present is pregnant with possibility, even if we can't always see it with our ordinary eyes, and to remember that we are not alone and never powerless. Shefa Gold writes that Shalach Lecha blesses us with both the mitzvah of remembering and a technology for filling that mitzvah. We are instructed to put tzitzit fringes on the corners of our garments and to place at each corner a thread of the purest blue. Looking upon that color, we will be reminded of the sea, and the sea will remind us of the heavens, and the heavens will remind us of the throne of glory that we glimpsed in a moment of clarity. Shalach Lecha gives us the spiritual challenge to remember what we have glimpsed and to plant that glimpse like a seed in the soil of my life. And Shalach Lecha warns me that if I deny that glimpse and if I doubt its validity, then I will be denied entrance to the promise, to the land of promise. The state of consciousness that witnesses divine presence filling the whole world. That's what the land of promise is. The state of consciousness that witnesses divine presence filling the whole world. To plant the seed of that glimpse requires that I acknowledge and celebrate it and that I nurture its growth with my loving attention. So as we confront the giants in our personal lives and the ones that plague the world, may we train ourselves to see with eyes strengthened by faith, and may that vision inspire us to walk in paths of righteousness so that we help to create a brighter tomorrow. And let's take a moment of silence now before we begin our discussion.